This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey, everyone. Do you wish you were somewhere sunny, but are dealing with another crazy spring? There's a solution to get that feeling. I'm grabbing a Hawaiian Breeze 5-Hour Energy and escaping there in my mind. Sports fans, ever stay up late for the game and drag the next day? A 5-Hour Energy shot will fix that no problem. 5-Hour Energy's website has tons of flavors, over 15 to choose from. Watermelon, Tropical Burst, Blue Raspberry, and even hard-to-find ones like Strawberry Lemonade and Extra Strength Fan Fuel. There's a flavor for everyone. You can even build your own 12 or 24 pack and have it delivered. Or grab a shot at your local store. They're everywhere. And it's basketball season. My schedule is packed and I don't want to miss a second, so I grab a 5-Hour Energy shot. They're perfect for back-to-back games or when my team plays late. 5-Hour Energy keeps me going through the game and the next morning. Visit 5hourenergy.com for deals and to stock up before tip-off.
What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980. We're always live as well on the free Odyssey app. We're streaming live on YouTube, too, at the Team 980. And the Wizards and Jazz are playing tonight, as you will hear here on the Team 980. Dave Johnson will join us 6 o'clock because it's game day. The whole deal. You know the deal. They're playing the Jazz, who have now passed them in the race to the bottom. Wizards and Jazz for NBA inferiority, but superiority when it comes to draft position. And that means today's top story is the NBA draft. And thus, it is time for Not My Beat.
Today's top story, from the perspective of someone who's there.
You are looking live.
This just in.
Not My Beat.
Jeremy Wu is an NBA draft analyst for ESPN.com, and with March Madness starting tomorrow, plus the big game tonight, we wanted to get a little bit more info on this NBA draft. So, Jeremy, really appreciate you joining us and spending some time.
Yeah, what's going on? Fun time of year, always.
Yeah, no, it's a good time, and especially, I think, for Wizards fans that have kind of been waiting for this, like, okay, let's see what we got here. Hopefully this is the nadir. This is the bottom. And they'll, you know, if they can win this draft lottery, great. We know they would take Cooper Flagg because Cooper Flagg is the best player in this draft. So I actually don't want to talk about Cooper Flagg because I think everyone more or less understands that he's the guy. And we've all known that since he was awesome on the USA Select team as a 17-year-old a year ago, if there was any doubt even then. So when you look at the best players in terms of NBA draft prospects that will play in March Madness, who is the next highest guy on your board? Is it Edgecombe from Baylor? Is it somebody else?
Yeah, for our list, it's Edgecombe, B.J. Edgecombe from Baylor. We have Trey Johnson from Texas, who will play tonight in the first four. And then, you know, the other Duke guys come in right after him. Obviously Dylan Harper and Ace Bailey and Rutgers will miss the tournament. So, you won't see them play this week. But also, I give you props because I think you're the first person who's been like, let's not talk about Cooper Flagg.
I mean, he's awesome. Like, what are we going to say? He's the best player in the draft. They win the lottery. They're taking Flagg. If they win the lottery, we can talk about him then. I got plenty of time to talk about Cooper Flagg. But, like, and there's nothing that, like, if he goes out and has a bad tournament, that's not going to change. People are like, oh, he rolled his ankle. Like, okay, fine. We'll see you in the NBA when you're the number one pick. So let me ask you this then. This is, I guess, a flag adjacent question, but just trying to understand some of those names you just said, the two Rutgers kids that aren't in the tournament. Like, what's the contour of this draft is the word I will use. Flagg's the number one guy. He's a number one pick in any year that's not Wembanyama, LeBron, like the elitist of the elite. He's a bona fide number one guy. For these next four, five, six guys, how deep is your next tier, and how good are those guys relative to other years?
Well, I think that's what people are, and what we've been trying to figure out is sort of like, to your point, like how steep is the drop off? I think from talking to people around the NBA, I think Dylan Harper probably is like the soft consensus number two. I think his skill set as a bigger ball handler, very strong, good feel. I think he kind of feels a little bit safer at number two than some of the other guys. Now, you might talk to someone who really, really believes in Harper's upside. You might talk to someone who views him as more of like a safe pick at number two. But I think, the fact that both those conversations are happening kind of points to why he's a cut above. And then you've got, I think the next group, Ace Bailey, his upside is huge. Big time shot maker, but still really learning the game. I think still very raw in a lot of ways that teams are trying to parse in terms of projecting him out. Edgecombe is kind of the same, right? Those two guys are, Bailey and Edgecombe probably have, top five upside. I think you could argue their upside is higher than anyone else that you would find lower than them on the board. But then the question is, how likely is it that they reach that? What is the best team fit situation for those guys to tap into that upside, right? So it's, you go from Flagg to Harper, and then you've got the next group, which I think is those two guys. And you could argue, Kamon Malawach or Trey Johnson or whoever, in terms of who you view as like the third pick. But it kind of just depends on your risk tolerance and how much you love the upside of guys like Bailey and Edgecombe.
So that's been one of the kind of the, I would say, overwhelming questions that we've been tackling here in D.C., and we've talked to some of the folks that cover the Wizards about this. I remember distinctly talking about it with Josh Robbins from The Athletic, where he's like, look, they want to develop good habits, they want to be competitive, but they need to lose. They need to have the worst record in the league, because a lot of folks think this is a five-player draft, and as long as even if you lose out on all four lottery spots, the worst you can be if you have the worst record is the fifth pick. Do you see that cutoff there at five? Do you think it's six? Or like, if the Wizards were to not get a top three pick, is that like an absolute catastrophe based off of the talent drop-off here?
Yeah, I mean, I look at it as, I think it becomes a tricky draft at three, just because of what I just said. It kind of depends on how you weight that stuff. It's going to be a ton of background, a ton of stuff that it's hard to say, from our position at this stage. But yeah, I do think I think three and four, at least you'll get someone, assuming it's one of those two, with pretty good upside. But again, I think the other point to what you just said about what Josh said, shout out to Josh, is that next year's draft looks very strong at the top. So if you are a team like Washington that does seem to be in a patient position, maybe there's a little bit less downside to taking someone who, obviously you want to hit on one of the top guys. But if you have to swing at three or four on the upside of someone like Bailey or Edgecombe, like, knowing that you might not be that much better next year, like at least they have, there are other teams in that same boat where at least you can like develop a guy for a year, and then next year you're looking at AJ DeBonsa or Cam Boozer or Darren Peterson, like those three guys. We have Nate Ament in that conversation as well. So like, those four guys, interesting, very high upside, going to be an interesting thing to watch unfold between now and next year too. But for some of these teams, when you're planning long term, it's like, well, at least we'll, if we don't get the guy we want this year, there are guys next year who are also high caliber prospects that you can start thinking about. So again, that's not necessarily the answer you want if you're a fan of a tanking team, but that's kind of the reality of the lottery wheel.
Sure. And of course, the answer you want is we won. We have Cooper Flagg. That's again, well established. Jeremy Wu, ESPN NBA draft analyst, with us here on the Hoffman Show. So the two Rutgers kids, Ace Bailey, Dylan Harper, they have two potentially top three picks, certainly two top five picks. They didn't make the NCAA tournament. Is that concerning at all?
Yeah, so I wrote a story on this last week or the week before. It's on ESPN.com, basically kind of asking that question to scouts, kind of digging into, how the NBA views it. And I think it's very, I think it's very case by case, right? Like, teams are going to look at every situation contextually. I think the prevailing thing I heard with Rutgers is just that people around the league felt that the supporting talent on their roster was not good enough to really place too much blame on a team where you have, you know, two teenagers using the vast majority of the possessions and not much other consistent options. On the other hand, you know, I think people do prefer to see a winning resume. Like, you know, this year, based on what we just talked about, like, it may not and it should not probably hurt them too much in terms of where they are drafted. But you do ask those overhead questions. Like, you know, scouts want to see you guys be part of successful frameworks. And then, again, you know, you can make the argument, well, at least guys like Trey Johnson from Texas or like Jeremiah Fears at Oklahoma, you know, those guys were in similar positions, also very young, using a ton of possessions on their teams, and those teams did make the tournament. So, again, Rutgers in the Big Ten, very tough league, wasn't a season that went their way. But I think it just kind of depends how you talk to. For me, it's kind of here and there. Like, obviously, it would be better if they made the tournament, but it's not like a catch-all criteria where it, like, makes or disqualifies someone as a very good prospect.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Derek Queen's another interesting guy that has a lot of interest here locally, obviously being a Maryland kid. What do you make of him and his prospects in the league and how much he could help them with a good tournament run here?
Yeah, I've been very impressed with what Derek has done. I can't say I expected him to be, just based off seeing him in high school, as impactful as he has been for Maryland. Definitely one of the best freshmen in the country. I think the skill set, I think we've all seen, is very real. There are still concerns, I think, long-term that teams have, and it's going to be sort of eye of the beholder that will sort of determine. I think he does have kind of a wide range just because of the defensive projection where he's not like a, you know, quick defender. He's not really a rim protector in an NBA sense where he's covering a ton of ground and challenging shots. And, I had a lot of scouts sort of just gripe to me privately just about his motor being inconsistent, like taking plays off defensively. And, you know, guys grow out of that. I think there's still a lot more good than bad to take away from for his season. And I've been very impressed with what Maryland's been able to do.
Last question for Jeremy Wu of ESPN, one of their NBA draft analysts. Wizards have another pick late in the first round, 25. Like last year, they got Keshawn George, and that turned out to be a steal because most guys that you draft at 25, like, they're not that good. He's pretty good as a rookie. Is there anybody that you like in that range late that you like a lot more than maybe some of the other mock drafters or some of the other boards that you're seeing or that you're maybe hearing some rumblings from scouts that like, hey, watch out for this guy at the end of the first round?
Well, I would say two things. Like, first of all, I think that's sort of an interesting range right now just because of the, you know, a lot of people around the NBA are anticipating just with NIL payments being much stronger and a much better financial alternative now if you're a fringe first rounder. Like, those late first round picks, I mean, you might see, you know, teams might see 20 to 40 guys off their top 100 or whatever many guys you rank. Like, you're going to see guys go back to school and it's going to thin out the pool. So like, I can throw someone out there and it may not be in the draft. I will say a guy who I think is playing well right now and is underrated. And I doubt he kind of makes it to 25, but is Will Riley from Illinois. I was at the Big Ten tournament. He's playing good basketball. He's very young. I think Jonathan Gavoni and I have been high on him, I think higher probably than some others, but I'm a believer in his talent, and I think not dissimilar from Keyshawn in some ways in terms of just needing to get stronger, great positional size, very different players, but just in terms of like a project pick. So I think teams are probably a little higher on him than they might want to let on, and I could see him going probably, you know, mid-first round, but I think we have a lot to play out in terms of the pre-draft process and which guys end up ultimately staying in the draft. So that's a big question, I think, for us trying to do this work as well.
Yeah, for sure. And then we all know that Will might package some of, you know, his 78 second round picks, try to move up a couple spots. We know that it's going to be chaos on draft night. Jeremy Wu, ESPN NBA draft analyst. You can read his and Jonathan Gavoni's work on ESPN.com. Jeremy, this was great, man. Really appreciate it. Thanks for some time.
Of course, no worries. Thank you.
All right, that's Jeremy Wu. When we get back, Let's run through a similar exercise on the women's side of things. Ben Pickman from The Athletic covers women's hoops for them, college and W. So let's take our first look really in earnest on the show at the women's NCAA tournament bracket. And we can highlight along the way some players that the Mystics will be looking at with their not one, not two, but three top six picks in next month's WNBA draft. Ben Pickman with us next. It's the Hoffman Show. We are on the Team 980. We are always live on the free Odyssey app, and we are streaming live on YouTube at the Team 980. We just talked about some of the top prospects in the men's NCAA tournament that we're keeping an eye on as the Wizards and Jazz play tonight, race to the bottom of the NBA. The Mystics, we already know, have three of the top six picks in the WNBA draft, and we haven't really had a chance to talk too much about the women's bracket over the last couple of days since it came out. Tournament starts a little bit later as well, but since we don't have a show tomorrow or Friday, we're now out of time, and it's time to do all of that at once. To help us do that, Ben Pickman joins us from The Athletic. Ben, great to catch up again. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Hopefully we can crash course this in whatever time we have.
Yeah, we can certainly do our best here. And so if we look at it just quickly, like overarching, we can get into the bracket and some of the matchups and some of the favorites and all that in a second. But when you look at the draft this year from and this college pool that we're going to be watching over the next couple of weeks through a WNBA lens, how deep is this group? Like, we know Paige Beckers is the belle of the ball at the top in the same way that Cooper Flagg is the belle of the ball in the men's field, although there's probably a little bit more contention on that than Flagg, who's universally seen as the number one guy on the men's side. But after Beckers, how deep is this draft where the Mystics have these three picks in the top six?
Yeah, there are a lot of potential players in this draft who could be really, really solid WNBA players, right? You go down the list, Kiki Uriofin, Sonia Citron, Sanaya Rivers, these are really, really good athletes. Olivia Miles protected a top three lottery pick as well. Frankly, the player who has the biggest star power potential, who could be a franchise player, is not someone in this NCAA tournament. It is Dominique Malanga, who is this 19-year-old center who plays in France. She's 6'6". She could dunk when she was like 14, 15 years old. She's been playing pro for a few years on the French national team at the Olympics. She's the kind of athlete that, frankly, you don't see very often in the WNBA. And so when you talk to executives, like, again, she's not in this NCAA tournament, so that doesn't really help in this preview, but she is the kind of player that if she is available at number three, I would be pretty surprised if Washington passed her up, because she really does have the potential. I know Beckers is kind of the big name here in America, the big name that everybody knows, but it's not crazy to think that in 5 years, 10 years' time, if developed the right way, Dominique Malanga is actually the best prospect looking back at this 2025 WNBA draft.
That is very interesting, but also not surprising, I think, for those of us that have been a little locked in on this. I remember, actually, ironically now, Ben, the first person to mention her to me was Mike Tebow. We were sitting down after an interview last year. He's like, yeah, there's this French kid over there that's 6'6", and she's awesome. And I was like, oh, and check it out. And here we are a year later, and we'll see if Washington can ultimately draft her at three. I do think, you know, if we try to now start to talk about some of the tournament as well. Is Notre Dame the most dangerous three seed that we've seen in the women's tournament going in a while, considering they have, what, four, five, six maybe future WNBA players on that roster, and yet somehow are a three seed?
Yeah, I mean, they're a three seed because they lost three of their last five games and really backed into this 2025 NCAA tournament. But I think your point that you make is a really good one, because they did win 19 straight games at one point during this regular season. They had ascended to the number one team in the AP poll. They do have, you know, potentially, what, like two or three of, you know, WNBA-level prospects, including two players who could go in the top five, and it wouldn't be shocking, in Miles and Sonia Citron. Like, they really are that deep. They really are that talented. Neil Ivey is one of the best coaches in the country. And so, yeah, they are super, super dangerous. I have them, you know, in my kind of circle, I'll call it circle of six, teams that I think have a legitimate chance to win the national championship. But they have a tough stretch. They have a tough path as a three seed, and it's one of those teams, like, do you want to bet on a team figuring it out in March, flipping the switch, or maybe something is off, and maybe their season is kind of going to end on a whimper, much like their ECC tournament run did, much like their conference regular season did too.
Ben Pickman of The Athletic with us here on The Hoffman Show. Obviously, also, or actually, it's not in their conference. God, my old Big East brain turned back on for a second. That thing's been dead for a while. UConn is who I was going to ask about, who's still in the Big East. Obviously, sure. Notre Dame no longer in the Big East. Do you think the committee got it right, putting them as a two seed with the four ones that they had, or was that a mistake by the committee?
No, I think it was a fair seed. I mean, people look at kind of UConn's conference record, and the Big East, frankly, is not as good as some of the other power conferences, not really considered as much like a power conference as, you know, the ACC or the SEC or the Big Ten. So that helps to explain the seeding, and it wasn't really surprising to see UConn as a two. I think the frustration people saw on Sunday night when the bracket was announced was more from USC coach Lindsey Gottlieb, who seemed to be a little bit peeved that they were the fourth number one seed in the committee's eyes, which meant they had to play UConn. And I think we might have seen a similar reaction from Texas coach Nick Schaefer had they been paired in the same bracket as UConn. But overall, I don't really think UConn cares where they're seeded, whether they were that number one seed or a top number two, because they recognize that to win the national championship, to go to a Final Four, you got to beat who's in front of you, and you got to beat everyone, right? And this UConn team, their win over South Carolina in February, for my money, it's the best win that any team had during this regular season. Going to Columbia, South Carolina, blowing out the defending champions on their home court in a game that really was never competitive. So UConn, to me, like, the ceiling is there. They have, I think, the highest ceiling of frankly, any team. Their best might be better than anyone else's best. And they did show that against South Carolina. And it's just a matter of, can they get to that level again, when the Field of 68 begins later this week.
Another two seed that's pretty interesting to me is TCU. Obviously, a lot of fans who check in and just in March every single year. We know more fans checked in on games this year than any other year prior. ESPN put out that press release a couple weeks ago that's like, yeah, we had more games of 500,000 viewers than any other year ever this season. But for a lot of folks that just check in to March every year on the tournaments, the last time they saw Haley Van Lith was Caitlin Clark cooking her when she was wearing an LSU uniform. Well, update, she's now with TCU. She's a Big 12 Player of the Year. How good is that TCU team, and do they have a chance? Like, is that one of the first teams that's outside of that circle of six you talked about, or are they in it for you as a potential true title contender?
No, I think they're outside the circle of six. I mean, this has already been the best year in the history of TCU women's basketball. They're number two in the region. They've led at halftime in 24 straight games and in an NCAA best 31 games. This year, they've already won a school record 31 games this year. Haley Van Lith, you mentioned her, Big 12 Player of the Year, and Sedona Prince is kind of the center, her front court partner from a pick and roll standpoint. They have great chemistry on the court together. It's a really good offense, not as good comparably as a defense. I just have a hard time seeing like them go from a team that is just trying to ascend to finally being in the Final Four. I mean, they are one of the best stories kind of in the sport more broadly this year in this way that last year in the 2024 season, they actually needed to hold open tryouts at one point during the 23-24 season and literally had to take players who were just lay students going to normal classes and bring them onto the women's basketball team just to continue their season at one point in the winter because they were so decimated with injuries. A year later, they are winning the Big 12, both in the regular season and the conference tournament, and being a two seed. And so, you know, it's crazy to think Mark Campbell's been there just a few years now. Like, it's crazy to think where they were from where they were to where they are now. But I think Final Four is possible, though I'm not betting it. And I think national championship, like, you just don't often see the team that goes from out of the tournament, not really a power player, to suddenly winning, especially on the women's side.
For sure. The powers that be tend to power on. In South Carolina, they've been the most powerful program in the country for better part of a decade now with Dawn. Last year was so surprising because it's like, oh, man, they missed their shot with Aaliyah Boston. This will be a down year. Then they went undefeated and won the national championship. This year, they're a one seed again. They had that nasty loss that you referenced earlier to UConn. How does this South Carolina team stack up? And what kind of form would you say that they're in going into this NCAA tournament?
They're in really, really good form. They blew out Texas, another number one seed in that SEC tournament final, and that is the kind of statement win that you want as you head into the NCAA tournament play. I mean, look, this is another really, really good South Carolina team. They are top five in offensive rating. They're 15th in defense. They're third overall in that rating. They don't really turn the ball over. They get out and run and score in transition. They're first in points in the paint. Like, they are also really deep. Like, just like last year's team, there's not one player that you can key in on and say, if we shut them down, we are definitely going to win. They have a number of players. Mileja Fulwiley, who is one of the best athletes in the tournament, a sophomore wing, sophomore guard, who's super exciting. Joyce Edwards, a freshman forward. She's one of the best freshmen in the country this year. Tahina Paopao, one of the best shooters in the country last year. Still a very, you know, consistent shooter, someone you can't leave open. So they just have a lot of options, a lot of depth, a lot of options. They're obviously really well coached. They're obviously really experienced and prepared heading into this tournament. So, you know, it's not an undefeated team. They might not be attracting all the headlines like they did last year, but this is still a South Carolina team that it would not be shocking if they won a second consecutive championship.
So going full circle to wrap up, Ben, is Ben Pickman from The Athletic is with us here on The Hoffman Show. Who is the player that you think has the, like, from what you think they can do and what their team can do, who's the player that you think can help their draft stock the most over the next 3 weeks? You just mentioned a ton of names that I think are, like, eligible candidates for me, from Sanaya Rivers to Paopao to, you know, a bunch of these different players. Who do you think can really help their WNBA draft stock in their final chance to do it before next month's draft?
Yeah, I mean, the player that I've kind of circled is Azy Fudd of UConn. Now, she could go back to college for another year if she so chooses, but she simply put has first-round talent. She is an elite shooter with a very pure stroke, very much in the kind of Steph Curry vein. She's also an Under Armour athlete, works out with Steph, has a good relationship with him, kind of this 3-and-D. But you could certainly see that, like, if she puts six incredible games together, then maybe she jumps to the WNBA and is not just a first-round pick like some people think and project she could be, but is a top half of the first-round pick. Again, an injury-riddled career in college so far. She's very close with Paige Beckers, so it wouldn't be shocking for if Azy left, because Paige is also expected to leave. And Azy played great against South Carolina. That was her best game of the year, and so if she's able to replicate it, like, she is certainly the kind of player who could see her name soar up draft boards and make the decision about whether to stay or whether to go. It could be a pretty simple one if she plays well and gets positive feedback as a result.
That would be the DMV's very own Azy Fudd, St. John's College High School, Arlington, Virginia. And Ben, I lied. I now have one more question, because you got me thinking on the local tick, and I meant to ask you this earlier. What kind of chance do you give Maryland to make a run to Sweet 16, Elite Eight kind of range?
Yeah, I think it's definitely possible. I think Alabama, not an easy matchup by any means. Again, coming out of the SEC, which was a really, really strong conference this year. Cheyenne Sellers, you know, obviously key to everything that Maryland has done this year, but the team, again, regrouped this offseason. One of the best teams in the Big Ten. Sellers, so much goes around what she can do. Another player, potentially, with some WNBA draft implications. For me, I expect them, certainly as a host team, to win that first-round game against Norfolk State. There's some people are saying that game is a little bit shakier than some people think. I think Alabama is actually a pretty tough test in the round of 32, but then I'm staring down, you know, you're staring down the barrel here. They would have to play South Carolina, theoretically, in the Sweet 16.
Right.
And so for as good as, you know, a season that Maryland has had, you know, and they've had a pretty good one, certainly, I don't really foresee it going much longer than that if they even get that.
Ben Pickman, you can read him and the entire team at The Athletic's work on The Athletic. Their app is great, easy to use. You can also just go to theathletic.com. Ben, appreciate your time, sir, and I'm sure we will be talking over the next month, over the course of this tournament and leading into that WNBA draft.
Enjoy the tournament.
You as well, my friend. Ben Pickman with us here on The Hoffman Show, which, as we move things around, Anthony, means we have a half-hour hole in the program. No?
We have rule changes. Also, we have Connor Orr, who you said is... We have a couple of things because we didn't finish all the NFL rule changes.
Well, I was thinking, because we had talked about as a possibility today... doing a special edition of Never Read the Comments. But in a way, Connor Orr subtweeting us in his article is kind of a Never Read the Comments.
Hey, I'm with it.
We're gonna have some fun with someone who decided to subtweet us in a national publication next.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And now, two pigeons who can't believe how good humans have it with DirecTV.
These humans are hopping from streaming apps to live sports without batting a wing.
All from the DirecTV home screen.
With just one click, you could be watching a baseball game, a movie on Netflix,
or a critically acclaimed documentary.
You watch documentaries?
I love the ones that leave you with a question.
What?
Exactly.
DirecTV, a better way to watch whatever you want to watch. Visit DirecTV.com.
Internet-connected Gemini device, separate Netflix membership, and additional paid subscriptions required for third-party apps.
So, I read in USA Today that the majority of people stop GLP-1 weight loss injection shots in a year. Now, what's concerning is if you get off GLP-1s, there's a real chance you can gain all the weight back. The solution? Alma said, a natural superfood protein shake. University studies show it optimizes your metabolism so you can lose weight easily, and Alma said it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Use Almased with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at almased.com. That's A-L-M-A-S-E-D.com.
Survivor 48 is here, and alongside it, we're bringing you a brand new season of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. If you're a Survivor super fan, you won't want to miss this deep dive into every episode where we break down how we designed the game, the biggest moves, your burning questions. It's the only podcast that gives you inside access to Survivor that nobody else can. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980. We're always live as well on the free Odyssey app. We're streaming live on YouTube, and we are, I'm trying to think of the right wording for this, Anthony. We're just like feeding a content cycle. It's like we're just eating ourselves here, is what we're about to do. Because Connor Orr said something on a podcast. Linnell brought it to me. We talked about it. Apparently, our response got back to Orr. Now he wrote about it, and now we're going to talk about what he wrote about.
That's fun.
It is the content cycle on display. So initially, what started this were comments by Connor Orr on the MMQB podcast, a podcast that he hosts with Albert Breer. They're smart guys, been around. I've listened from time to time. It's not in my regular rotation, but I've heard clips and all that kind of stuff. Anthony, do you happen to remember what day that we did this with Linnell? What's today? Today's the 19th. I think it was.
It was on a Wednesday.
Yeah, so it was a week ago today. Here we go. This is the bite. Okay, this is what started it all. Admittedly, this is cut because we can't play their whole podcast. One, we don't have the time. Two, that's illegal because it's their podcast. If you want to go listen to their podcast, you can listen to their podcast. But I do not believe in listening to the fullness of the clip that we are taking this at all out of context.
I did not like Washington's free agency at all. I hate the idea of microwaving this process and just being like, oh, okay, we made it to the NFC title game. Let's get Deebo Samuel and Laremy Tunsil and let's trade away all of our picks for veteran guys and bop, 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 bop. This, you know, it's not 2010 anymore. Like, it doesn't necessarily work that way. And now you're putting a lot on Jaden Daniels' plate. And for everybody that's telling me, well, you have to strike while the iron's hot.
Yeah.
That's what the Jets said with Mark Sanchez. That's what the Texans said with CJ Stroud. That's what all these teams, you know, that's what the Eagles said with Carson Wentz. And it ended up just overloading these guys. And then they were never the same.
I thought that was incredibly stupid for a million reasons. We talked about it. And then I was in my Twitter mentions, which is a place I don't go very often because I literally don't use Twitter for anything but trying to find links and all that kind of stuff. And I see that someone had responded to an article that Orr wrote earlier in the week and tagged me saying, hey, I see you responding to Craig. I think the answer is to try to grow this roster a little more organically, blah, blah, blah. And so I clicked on the article, and here's what Orr wrote about the Commanders. Let's talk about the Commanders in a little more detail. Shockingly, a truncated clip of something I said generated some frustration in a local market that assumes I either hate the franchise, haven't examined it thoroughly enough, or that I'm baiting people into getting upset. I can assure you that there are all three of these assertions are 100% true. Kidding. First of all, we like a little self-deprecation. Points for Connor Orr. That's funny. Second of all, if you're talking specifically about our show, I don't think you hate the franchise, haven't examined it thoroughly enough, or are baiting people. I just think you're wrong on multiple fronts and your analysis was bad. So I'm happy to have Connor on and we can talk about it. And I will say that to his face as well, because I don't think anything he said was remotely correct in terms of how it was characterized. But I do think that once you get past the snippiness, he does bring up some interesting questions, make some interesting points. So let's engage in good faith and read the rest of what he said. You ready to go, Anthony?
I'm locked and loaded. Let's get it.
All right. When I talked about my concern with the Commanders offseason and a kind of microwaving of their process after making it to the NFC Championship game, most people took issues with the examples I gave of similar processes gone wrong, specifically Mark Sanchez and the Jets.
Yeah, because Mark Sanchez was Mark Sanchez and Jaden Daniels is Jaden Daniels.
Hello. Anyway. While it's true that Sanchez was helped immeasurably by the addition of LaDainian Tomlinson, the continued additions to maximize the team's championship window, Santonio Holmes, Plexico Burris, Derek Mason, absolutely torpedoed the club, and those who believe it had nothing to do with the deflation of the Rex Ryan era simply weren't there to see it happen. So how about some other examples that I think bolster my point? After Andrew Luck's rookie season, the Colts felt a kind of pressure to improve the roster immediately and compete for a championship. They traded a first-round pick for Trent Richardson. After Baker Mayfield's promising start, the Cleveland Browns traded for Odell Beckham to pair with Jarvis Landry, lest I remind you of this fun little controversy, which seems so lovingly harmless for the Browns in 2025. There was the whole, it's a link to an article about the whole Odell thing. After Kyler Murray's ascension, the Arizona Cardinals hammered the gas pedal and traded for DeAndre Hopkins, enjoying one Pro Bowl season before getting two incomplete seasons and a suspension for performance-enhancing drug use. What about Trevor Lawrence? Our antenna were certainly up when the Jacksonville Jaguars paid a king's ransom for Christian Kirk and aggressively swooped in on Evan Ingram as well. My point is that Deebo Samuel, who had the worst yards per route run total of his career in 2024 and has had a kind of mixed history when it comes to being a great teammate, at least deserves consideration before we throw up our hands and declare the Commanders an overwhelming winner of the offseason. The same can be said for Laremy Tunsil, who is great but was also available for a reason. NFL teams don't just trade in-prime franchise left tackles while their young QBs are still on their rookie deals. On the podcast, co-host Albert Breer posed a fair question in rebuttal. What would I do instead? And I think the answer is to try to grow this roster a little more organically. And here's where I think he actually makes a good point. Cooper Kupp was so much more valuable to Stafford than anyone else. Ja'Marr Chase is indefinitely more helpful to Joe Burrow than any other wideout with the Cincinnati Bengals. Receivers who are pre-baked into the system, its quirks and its intricacies, are far more likely to bail a quarterback out of a bad spot than a ringer brought in from an offense that was falling apart, especially a receiver who took a fair number of snaps at running back over the 2 years. I have no problem bringing back Ertz and Wagner, who were part of the reason the team was there in the first place, but why not empower them to cook and help mentor the new crop of drafted talent? I suppose the great sin here is doubting Quinn's ability to keep everyone happy and committed. The last part is the most important, and I'll start there because I think it is a level of humility and kind of the answering of his own question that was, if you're defending the Washington plan, is needed. My issue with all of the other examples is those are other examples. And yes, Ja'Marr Chase and Cooper Kupp, I'm glad he did both of those because Ja'Marr Chase would have helped any offense because he's Ja'Marr freaking Chase. But Cooper Kupp was not some sure thing coming out of the draft. He was not a top five pick, and he's very much the perfect Sean McVay receiver for a decade, which is why he was Cooper Kupp. And him being able to play with Sean in that system and growing first Jared Goff and then being able to help integrate with Matthew Stafford
Like, okay, fine. The organic route, specifically at receiver, might make sense. But like, the 2007 New England Patriots that traded for Randy Moss, he fit in quite fine. And I'm not saying Debo is 2007 Randy Moss, but they had a plan for him, they used it, and it worked. The reason Debo's fine here, and basically also I would say Ja'Marr Chase is one of the most physically gifted and incredibly mentally smart guys in the league. Cooper Kupp might be the smartest wide receiver in the entire NFL. Add that with Sean McVay, no wonder it worked. Had Cooper Kupp been drafted by someone else and, you know, maybe cut after 2 years because it didn't work out and signed with Sean McVay, Cooper Kupp would have turned into Cooper Kupp whether they drafted him or not. The question is not about how the player is acquired. The question is whether the player fits. And that, I think, is the first mistake in saying that they're like microwaving this, right? They're drafting or they're acquiring guys in ways that, like, with specific roles in mind. Like, that was the magic last year. Everybody, like, they won 12 games last year with all new guys. There was no incumbency. So trying to make an argument that a team needs to just grow from the inside when last year they planted a bunch of stuff from other places because Ron Rivera left the cupboard that bare that they changed over literally more players than anyone else in the league is an argument that kind of falls flat because they've already proven they can do it. And so I think you're just, to me, Anthony, if the argument is they're microwaving this, you are focused on the wrong things. You're focused on the how the player is acquired, not who they acquired and how they fit with the actual football team for which they will be playing in 2025.
Yeah, I think the point that you made about the roster overhaul that Dan Quinn and Adam Peters did last year where we bring in 28, 29 new free agents is very telling. And unless you have that background knowledge about, you know, why, you know, we're upgrading at receiver, you know, us bringing in Debo's and upgrade for Zacchaeus and the manner in which we use Zacchaeus kind of thing. So I think it's null and void for him to, you know, say something like that, especially if you don't. Maybe he does, you know, fully understand what we did last year, but I think us being in this market, we better have a sense for the team and sort of kind of what they're doing.
I mean, sure, I don't hold that against him. What I disagree with and would be happy to have him on the show to talk about is the fact that all, like, bringing up more bad examples doesn't make your argument right. Let's go through the examples that he brought up real quick. He goes back to the Jets one and all those guys. Okay, Rex Ryan as a people manager versus Dan Quinn as a people manager, no contest. Also, how many other of the coaches and executives on that staff got other jobs in the league after? Not very many. They got a ton of jobs at GetUp on ESPN. I'm not saying they're dumb. They're football dummies. Rex Ryan certainly had other jobs and, you know, it was a mixed bag as a head coach, and that's fine. But, like, the ability to make the egos and manage and all that kind of stuff, I think Dan Quinn is far better suited. And, again, they're picking specific guys here. And also, like, Santonio Holmes, Plaxico Burress, like, I don't know that those are the easiest personalities. And I don't know that Debo is either, but he's one. Tunsil, I don't know, is the easiest personality, but, like, nobody says Laremy Tunsil's a bad teammate. They say he's not a leader. They don't need him to be a leader here. They know that. They know that going in. Also, Adam Peters knows Debo Samuel. These aren't new things. Andrew Luck, you can't, like, one, did anybody think trading a first-round pick for Trent Richardson was a good idea at the time? No. So bringing up a team that made a dumb move that we knew at the time, and then Andrew Luck's injury history was terrible. Every time he was healthy, they were good. When they weren't, he was bad. Whatever. Trying to compare what Baker did as a rookie to what Jaden did, and again, the personality of someone like Debo versus someone like Odell. And by the way, Debo better behave because he's on a one-year deal. Very different. After Kyler Murray's ascension, the Cardinals traded for DeAndre Hopkins, got one Pro Bowl season, and then two incomplete seasons and the suspension. Yeah, maybe let's not have our guy get suspended and things would have gone a little better, but a lot of that was injury-related. Like, those Cliff teams, as we revisited a ton last offseason, were pretty good to get started, and then they fell apart, quite literally. And then with Lawrence, everyone said that the Christian Kirk deal wasn't a great one. And they were big on Evan Ingram. They had some good years. They made multiple playoff runs. But also, Trent Baalke is thought of to be like some kind of dark artist who we didn't even know how he kept his job so long until he finally got fired this offseason. Nobody thought Trent Baalke was actually good as an executive. Look at what we think of what Adam Peters is. And so instead of focusing on a bunch of people who have proven to not be very good at the job doing, following similar paths, quit. This has been my thing this entire offseason. It's not about the path. It's not about the plan. There is no perfect plan. It's about executing the plan. If you can build a championship contender with all trades and no draft picks, be my guest, as long as you win. If you can do it without a single trade or a single free agent acquisition, that's fine. But you are at the mercy of being of the market, which is a phrase. Now I feel like Linnell, or the catchphrase. You're at the mercy of the market, because he always talking about the mercy of the evaluator, right? But like, ultimately, you have to respond to the market. I'm going to un-catchphrase myself. You have to have the ability to respond to the market. This market for this team was better in trades than free agency. Their ability to draft difference makers at 29 versus last year at 2 is very, very different. And I do believe that they have used some of these picks smartly. They know the cap situation. They're going to be able to afford these guys long-term if they're good. And they still have just enough draft capital to still get guys. And by the way, there's guys in the hopper from last year like Jordan McGee and Dominique Hampton that they certainly, Luke McCaffrey, who they think are going to take bigger steps this season. So, yeah, all the like, again, the obsession with the plan is, to me, the silliest ongoing piece of NFL analysis. Whatever your plan is, be good at it. If you can't trade up for a quarterback unless you're the Chiefs and you draft Patrick Mahomes. The Bears did it. They traded up for Mitchell Trubisky. Trading up for a quarterback is stupid. Let me give you all the examples of every team that's traded up for quarterbacks. The Eagles with Carson Wentz. The Bears for Trubisky. Go on down the list of teams that have bombed that. And I'll give you the Chiefs and Mahomes and say, well, they were right. Being right is the most important thing, not how you actually approach the plan. Not to say it doesn't matter, not to say there aren't choices you have to make along the way, but this obsession with homegrown organic talent when there isn't a whole lot here, and they're probably telling us something about what they think of this draft, maybe we should listen.
I think you said that succinctly. One thing I will also add in terms of like the plan, sometimes that plan doesn't work though. I think if you look at the Dolphins, and maybe this is probably what he's doing or trying to get at, and how they sort of kind of, microwave their situation, bringing in Tyreek Hill. You had Waddle, too, was building on like what he, his first couple of seasons.
They had some, like, their two-year stretch before this year when Tua got hurt was like their best two-year stretch in forever.
Exactly. So I think, but I'm saying, like, bringing in Tyreek Hill, though, you would assume that they were, do a little bit better. Granted, they end up going to the playoffs. They end up losing. But does that count as a failure kind of thing? Or it just didn't work kind of thing?
Would they have been better? Let me ask you this. If they had saved whatever draft capital, do you think it is possible that the Dolphins could have been better without Tyreek Hill?
No.
Things that happened to the Dolphins. Every single edge player they got hurt.
Yep, that too.
That probably mattered a lot. That playoff run, they lose Bradley Chubb right before the end of the season. I think that probably had a big deal. But no one wants to talk about that. They just went, oh, the plan, they made a trade, and that's why. No. It's football. Stuff happens.
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking down. Okay, here are the teams with double-digit wins last year. You tell me how they're built. The Buffalo Bills, they're built on the back of Josh Allen.
Yeah.
The Baltimore Ravens. Who was the second most important Raven, arguably, last year?
Probably Derrick Henry.
How was he acquired?
Free agency, actually.
Yeah, not homegrown. Best year they had in a while. Yeah. They've been good, but that was probably the best Ravens team that I think most people said. Also, Lamar probably grew more, and he also had a different task last year because of Henry's presence. The Steelers, I don't know what the Steelers are. They're homegrown, but also not grown. They're Mike Tomlin. Texans, microwaved. most of the dudes they microwaved outside of Mixon got, like, Diggs got hurt. They fell apart with injuries. And also, I don't want to hear the Texans' comparisons to the Commanders because I would assume that Cliff Kingsbury doesn't forget every single thing that got him to this point. Next year, he's just a much more experienced play caller than Bobby Slowick. And Bobby Slowick went from head coaching interviews to getting fired. I think that had more to do with the Texans' failures than anything about the roster moves that they made. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Okay. The Chiefs, they're kind of homegrown. Mahomes, you know, they traded up for him. Obviously, Kelce, Chris Jones. They've made a couple of smart acquisitions. They've also done an incredible job of developing players. Fine. I'll give you the Chiefs. Chargers, they remade everything last year. Jim Harbaugh puts it together with bubblegum and scotch tape and running the football, and next thing you know, they're 11-6. The Broncos won 10 games. Would you follow the Broncos plan? Hey, guys, how do we get an $80 million dead cap hit? We want to do the Broncos plan. They're well coached. They did a good job with Bo. Their defense is sick. If you can draft the best corner in football, you should do that. Pat Surtain's awesome. Anchor of their defense. Eagles. Eagles are fun because everyone loves to say that they're homegrown. Who are the three best players on the Eagles, Anthony?
So you got Saquon, you got AJ, and then you got...
I would say Jalen Carter.
Oh, yeah, Jalen Carter.
Although, if you want to make an argument, Mailata, Lane Johnson, like, their O-line is sick. But I would say Carter, Saquon, AJ are probably the three best players on that team. Literally, one was acquired via free agency, one was traded for, and one was drafted. Please tell me more about how they're entirely organically homegrown. Washington, Detroit, homegrown, except for the part where they traded for their quarterback.
Yep.
The Vikings, mixed bag homegrownness versus other things. They signed Darnold in free agency. Packers, they're actually very homegrown to the point that some of it's a problem. They need other positions. If the Packers had more talent and weren't quite so homegrown, they'd actually probably be a better football team.
Yep.
On down the list you go. So I think we made our point, I guess is my point. Connor, we await your next podcast or writing. Or you can come on the show and we can talk about it. Just reach out. I'm not that hard to find. When we get back, Dave Johnson joins us ahead of Jazz and Wizards tonight.